This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Last Saturday, the organisers of the Supernova Music Festival, taking place in the Negev Desert, Israel, put up a post on social media. It read, "The time has come when the whole family is about to get together again, and what fun it's going to be." Hours later, and 260 or more of that family of music fans have been killed by the Palestinian militant group Hamas. Altogether, more than 1,200 Israelis died in the incursion. A similar number of Palestinians are thought to have died so far in Israel's response. Such an attack was bound to provoke a massive reaction. So what was Hamas's thinking? What went wrong with Israel's preparedness? And what's likely to happen now? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll try to find out. Joining me in the briefing room are Shashank Joshi, defence editor at The Economist, and Jennifer Jeffries, director of curriculum at the Security Studies programme in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. In 2021, Jennifer joined us for our programme What Does Hamas Want?, which is available now on BBC Sounds. In this discussion, we'll look at Hamas first. And Jennifer Jeffries, back in 2021, when you were on the programme, you told us how Hamas had evolved from being a religious social action body, essentially, to being an armed force. Can you just remind us now of how Hamas came to run Gaza?
Absolutely. So we talked in 2021 about the fact that, you know, Hamas emerged in the 1980s sort of as this counterbalance to the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which had really been the voice of the Palestinian people from the 1960s and was a designated terrorist organization itself. And then when the first Palestinian uprising occurred in the late 1980s, the PLO and Hamas sort of competed to be viewed as the leader behind it, because this leadership would give significant legitimacy to each organization in the eyes of the Palestinian people. And Hamas really leaned on its religious element to sort of promote its cause. They produced extensive messaging during this time, focusing on Islam as the solution to the injustice that the Palestinians were rebelling against. And this painted the PLO into a more secular corner and perhaps was part of the motivation for the PLO to engage in peace talks with Israel throughout the 90s and become recognized as a legit organization, although renamed as the Palestinian Authority, this sort of government in waiting, and a party, a political party called Fatah. But Hamas didn't go away when that happened. Instead, it sort of gave them greater weight for the element that they focused on in the context of resistance. And so when in 2006, the newly formed Palestinian Authority held parliamentary elections, Hamas actually won by a large margin. margin. They were seen as less corrupt, as more efficient, and as more committed to the Palestinian cause than Fatah was. And so the leader of Hamas was invited to form a government, but numerous Western states who had been providing aid to the Palestinian Authority since that agreement with Israel threatened to withdraw that funding if Hamas did not meet certain criteria, particularly relating to their position on Israel. And so the Palestinian president decided to dissolve the elected parliament and created a new one that did not include Hamas so that that funding could be turned back on. And Hamas was very unhappy with this development. And the result was a really bloody conflict between these two rivals in 2007, where they were literally throwing leaders of each organization off of really tall buildings in Gaza. And eventually Fatah effectively withdrew, although Hamas would say that they were kicked out. And since that time, Hamas has controlled Gaza and Fatah has, for the most part, controlled the West Bank.
Now, since that moment, 2006-07, have there ever been an electoral test of Hamas in Gaza? Is there an opposition to them? And can we gauge their current level of support? And you can see what I'm asking here, which is, where do the people of Gaza fit into all this politically?
Yeah, so Hamas holds internal elections to figure out their own leadership structures, but they don't hold elections within Gaza as though there's this clear alternative to Hamas. However, there are plenty of organizations that do polling both in Gaza and across the West Bank and have done since that 2006 event that caught everyone off guard when Hamas did win elections. And pretty consistently from then until now, if there were to be parliamentary elections, even between, so not just within Gaza, but between the West Bank, all of the Palestinian territories, it has pretty consistently said that Hamas would win at least a majority of the votes, but perhaps not enough to form a single government. They would need to partner with other groups, but it is likely that Hamas would once again take control of the Palestinian Authority were there to actually be elections.
To push the point a little bit, is there actually any opposition to Hamas in Gaza that's allowed to be organized?
I mean, yes and no. So there are a number of other groups operating within Gaza, most of which are armed wings. So you have Palestinian Islamic Jihad. You actually have a sort of by extension, very separated from the main Fatah party, but the Al-Aqsa Brigade, which is another armed group. And there are a few others there that Hamas actually over the years has tried to sort of stomp down, probably more from their own political interest than because of their concerns about, you know, violence extending beyond the borders of Gaza. But I would say that they are relatively cemented in their control of that area.
Shashank Joshi, when you see Hamas spokespeople on television, they're abroad, essentially. Can you tell us how Hamas's leadership is actually organised and where it's located?
There is a military wing, and the main leadership is in Gaza. And since 2017, we've seen almost a consolidation of power amongst the hardliners, mostly based in Gaza. But there is almost a political wing, that many of whom are based abroad. That's partly because of the difficulty of traveling outside of the Gaza Strip. It's partly because Hamas leaders want to be able to meet their diplomatic partners in the Arab world and other places. And so, for instance, some of my colleagues just the other day, a few days ago, conducted an interview with Musa Abu Marzouk, who's a senior member of the Hamas Politburo, which is a nice sort of archaic term that they use, for an interview in Doha, the capital of Qatar, where they have a base. And he, of course, you know, sort of pretended the atrocities hadn't occurred. He said he wasn't aware of them. He hadn't been told ahead of time the attack was coming, which I think tells you something as well. But the really interesting thing is one of the key divides is between those inside Gaza and those outside. And the sense, I think, within Gaza, looking at the outsiders as being people who are coddled sitting in five-star hotels in Doha while they get on and do the actual fighting and killing, which is a very common division that one sees in militant groups over the years, of a political wing outside, often engaged in diplomacy in nice, comfortable circumstances, and an armed wing, often more hardline, that is doing the actual brutal work of massacring or killing people.
So if we see some spokesman from Hamas pop up in somewhere like Doha or abroad, actually, we probably shouldn't take too much notice of what they say because they're not the main players.
Well, it depends what you mean by main players, because they may be main players in Hamas's political strategy. They may be shaping what they are saying to Egyptian intelligence, which, of course, has a very important role in brokering peace agreements when this kind of violence flares up in the past. They may have an important role in shaping debates over Hamas's strategy about political settlements. But these divisions still persist. And if you're asking, you know, what does this mean for military strategy? What does this mean for actions on the ground by people with guns and people with bombs? In that case, I would say that those sitting in Qatar are far less relevant.
Right. Jennifer, how is government and society in Gaza actually funded? I mean, the very broad picture we get is one of total immiseration inside Gaza and so on. But actually, there has to be money to keep things rolling. And there's some suggestion that other Arab governments have actually put large amounts of money in to try and improve conditions in Gaza.
That's correct. And not just other Arab governments, but also, I mean, there are humanitarian organizations that try to alleviate some of those challenges. And Israel itself actually, you know, supports certain hospitals and offers medical opportunities and things. Not now, of course, with this total blockade. But prior to that, there have been a number of groups that are not, and I think it's important to distinguish, they're not necessarily, or they're fundamentally not supporting Hamas, but they're supporting the fact that there is this entire population that is sort of stuck in this situation and they can't freely cross the borders and they can't freely access the resources that they need. And so it's very difficult to support that population from, of course, those that are holding positions of power in this relatively very small area. And so the states try to sort of walk that line between offering aid to those in need within Gaza versus actively supporting Hamas.
Right, let's come now to the weekend's attack itself. Jennifer, you've been looking at Hamas for a very long time. How surprised were you at what happened?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that given the length of time that I've been looking at them, that I was incredibly surprised. There were a lot of indications. I mean, even, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and I know when I was on the program in 2021, I talked about this sort of moderating effect that governance has on opposition groups. I mean, right, it's tough to be the guy out and or the gal out, I suppose, calling for, you know, total destruction of a state that has the ability to annihilate you while also being responsible for making sure that, you know, the garbage gets picked up and the mail is delivered. And so usually we see this sort of moderating effect. And in the time between 2007 and a week ago, we had seen evidence of that. You had seen Hamas sort of revamp their charter, or at least the principles as they described them, that seemed to indicate space for a potential two-state solution if it was something that they felt that the Palestinians across the board would support. You had numerous efforts to form unity governments with Fatah. And so I thought that that was indicative of this political wing having greater control than the militant wing, and also in part because Hamas had made efforts to limit the actions of PIJ and other groups that were sort of continuing this very violent existence. That's not to say that the military wing didn't continue to act. I mean, we've seen rockets for years and years going across the borders into Israel. But what I think I underestimated was how much that militant wing had grown, not only in their military capacity, but also in their influence within the Hamas organization, to the degree that they were able to pull off something like this.
Shashank, I want to talk about the Israeli situation in a moment and what deficiencies led to them being so vulnerable. But just looking at it from the point of view, because you observe these things, of whether or not you thought such an attack was likely or possible at that scale, what was your view?
I wouldn't have thought it possible, I confess as well. You know, it's the trend in military thinking, David, is the idea that modern sensor technology, drones, cameras, artificial intelligence to recognize people moving towards those cameras, vibration sensors to detect movement on the ground, that all those things had made it very difficult for armies to concentrate their forces. And you might think the same would apply to militants crossing at 26 different points and flooding 1,500 people across. I would not have expected that Israeli intelligence at the tactical level would be so poor. But I also have to say, I wouldn't have expected Hamas's military assault to have been so proficient, because it wasn't just the element of surprise. It was also the active suppression of those cameras by using drones, by using sniper rifles. It was using, from what we see, the early reports, electronic warfare to jam Israeli communications so they couldn't get the message out. And I think all of that suggests a really impressive degree of organization, even if the results were utterly revolting.
I want to put this to you. Do you think Hamas expected this attack to have the consequences that it did? In other words, do you think that they anticipated that they would be able to get so many people over the border, find themselves in open country and with orders to shoot and kill and take hostages?
I'm not sure. And the reason I'm not sure is that I think they must have realized that they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams, and that, you know, they couldn't have hoped they would still have been present and fighting inside Israeli soil, inside Israeli communities, 3 days after the attack. This is the most intense fighting on Israel's core territory. It's pre-1967 borders since the War of Independence in 1948. It's extraordinary. On the other hand, the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, have said in recent days that they think some elements of Hamas actually thought they might even seize and hold a corridor to these southern communities. In other words, this wasn't just a raid. They thought they might actually seize territory. If that's true, it suggests absolutely audacious ambition, given what we would have estimated of the group even a few weeks ago.
Jennifer, do you think Hamas now, as we record this, is in a situation that actually it hadn't planned for?
I think yes. And I think that agreeing entirely with sort of the two scenarios that Shashank just identified, and that's because essentially either this was a success beyond their wildest expectations, or not a failure, but a decrease in what they had anticipated. If they had truly expected to be beyond the borders of Gaza in a more permanent sense, then obviously this is a letdown. And so in either case, I don't know that they had planned, and I don't have indications to say that they had planned either to be so successful or if they hadn't been as successful as they had hoped. And in the not as successful as they hoped, honestly, I still think the jury is out on this. I think that tomorrow is going to be a really significant indicator of whether this other piece that they may have been anticipating. My understanding is there's no intelligence yet that confirms that Iran was part of the planning or that Hezbollah was, you know, part of this. But at the same time, you look at what the leaders, both in Gaza and also the political leadership sitting in Qatar, are calling for. And they are calling for Jordanian Palestinians to flood the West Bank and try to essentially gain territory there. And you have the calls for Hezbollah and to some extent sort of a weak answer from Hezbollah, but this willingness to come in from the north. And so if there was this bigger goal to actually take territory, then I think they're probably wondering if this is actually going to go through or if they're sort of sitting in a situation that they didn't expect where they really are kind of on their own in this.
Well, Shashank, that then begs the immediate question. Do you think that any of that will happen?
I think the critical question for me is less about the West Bank and some of that than it is of whether the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah intervenes in this war. That's the big question, because Hezbollah is an extremely powerful organization. They shocked Israel by showing remarkable military capacity in firing 4,000 rockets in 2006. They have dramatically improved since then. Their rocket arsenal has grown tenfold. It's about 150,000. They have precision missiles they didn't have in 2006 that could strike specific bases. And they're a pretty sophisticated force, including with anti-ship missiles and other sorts of things. They could overwhelm Israel's missile defenses. I think it comes down to whether Iran encourages them to step in and to impose a greater cost on Israel while it's tied down, or whether Iran judges that with an American aircraft carrier strike group in the Eastern Med, with a warning to Iran to stay out, and with Iran's own consideration of keeping Hezbollah as a sort of deterrent force in a future war that may involve Iran directly, that they should really lob a few rockets, flex their muscles, but stay out of it. Right now, I honestly don't know. I think they will probably stay out of it for a while, but it's a really tense moment, because that would be the pathway to a wider regional conflict that's much bigger than just this one focused on Gaza.
And a very direct question which follows immediately upon that one. If Hezbollah did do this thing that you, I think you're saying you probably don't anticipate they will do, will the Americans actually use strike power against them to augment Israeli action?
My sense is that the Americans would be very cautious, because that would then open American interests in the Middle East to retaliation, not just by Iran, but also by Iran's proxy militia in the region, such as the Houthis in Yemen and militia, Shia militia in Iraq and Syria. And I think they could do considerable damage. Don't forget, we saw that in a highly precise attack by Iranian missiles against Al-Assad Air Base, against America's forces in January 2020. What I do think will happen is that the escort ships around this aircraft carrier, which are equipped with Aegis missile defense systems, may try to mitigate the effect of any Hezbollah missile barrage against Israel. And that, I think, would be a significant contribution to Israel's defense.
Jennifer, do you think Hamas have planned for a situation whereby there will be likely to be a significant ground incursion by Israeli troops in the near future?
I think it depends on whether they knew they were going to be able to take the number of hostages that they did. If we interpret this as they consider this a resounding success greater than they ever imagined, then it could have been that their initial goal was to, you know, break through in a couple of places and maybe take an Israeli soldier or two, which that alone has enormous implications. I mean, we all remember Gilad Shalit, right? And the enormous campaign that was present in Israel for quite some time to bring him home, and over 1,000 Hamas prisoners traded for a single Israeli soldier. And so if they had not anticipated having all of these hostages, I think that is part of what is drawing so much of Israel's ire right now. But it's also what's complicating Israel's response, because you do have, you know, upwards of 150 people that are not in any way affiliated with Hamas or the Palestinian cause that are inside Gaza right now. And responses are limited as a result of that.
Okay, Shashank, let's talk about Israel now. The comparison's been made with the Yom Kippur War of exactly 50 years ago. Can you explain why, in Israeli terms, that comparison has been made?
It's been made principally because in October 1973, the Israeli armed forces, the Israeli government, was shocked by a military attack from Egypt and Syria that they didn't anticipate. And they were shocked for some rather mundane reasons to do with the failure of intelligence, but in a similar way to their misunderstanding of Hamas's intentions and capability, they were also shocked because of their political and conceptual failure to understand their Arab opponents, and particularly their underestimation of Arab military power, which they had, of course, defeated handily in 6 days, famously in 1967, a few years previously. And they thought, you know, we're superior, we can handle anything, they can't possibly attack us. And it was that sense of shock that resulted in the trauma of Yom Kippur. Now, the difference is partly, I would say, that Yom Kippur never penetrated the innermost parts of Israel. Civilians didn't suffer. It was Israeli soldiers, many thousands of Israeli soldiers, but not civilians. They weren't slaughtered. But another difference, I would say, and this is a fairly important one, which we must bear in mind, is that the Israel of 1973, although a nuclear-armed power by that time, did view that attack as existential. It provoked a real sense that the future of the state of Israel might be at risk, that Israel might not survive. And of course, you know, this was not all that many decades after independence. Today, I think that's no longer present. Hamas has committed the biggest mass murder of Jews since the Holocaust, but I don't think there's a sense it can march into Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and overthrow the Israeli government. So Israel is secure, but that sense of trauma that had been expunged, I think, by the peace deals with the Arab states of the 70s and the Oslo Accords, I think that has now collapsed in the way that it did in 1973.
Now, what do you think explains the failure? I mean, was it primarily an underestimation, an intelligence failure, an over-reliance, as you suggested, upon technology? Where would you put the major lessons that Israel should now derive from the experience?
There's so many things we could point to, but I would pick out an over-reliance on electronic intelligence, electronic surveillance, and technology. Israel controlled Gaza's telecommunications, its phone network. It could eavesdrop at will. It had cameras trained on the place. It had blanket air cover. And I think what we see is that against an adversary who is willing to practice fantastic operational security, not using the phones, or as Hamas did, according to early reports, use their phones to say to each other, actually, we're not ready to attack Israel. In other words, for active deception. It's, I think, a reminder that if all of that breaks down, you still need people on the ground who can respond quickly. And I think that's a huge lesson for Western armies, for NATO armies, who have also become increasingly reliant on technology and sensors and have lightened the amount of people in their army. They've shrunk, they've reduced the number of forces. I think that's a huge problem. But I would think there are also some more mundane reasons, which is to say, Israel, as you know, is in the midst of a major political crisis. It's a very divided country. And Israel's military intelligence system is heavily reliant on reservists. And it was many reservists who were at the forefront of the opposition to Benjamin Netanyahu's judicial reforms that were so controversial. And his government had also concentrated its efforts and attention on the West Bank. They had done a major operation, a counterterrorism operation in July in the West Bank. The West Bank was restive. I think they fundamentally took their eye off the ball in the South, and they were punished in the most brutal fashion.
Jennifer, how should we reassess Hamas's capabilities after this?
I think we need to realize that the connection between the political and the militant wings, if not in ideological alignment, are less defined than at least I understood them to be. And in that sense, I don't necessarily mean that you don't have groups within Hamas or factions within Hamas that would still push for a more moderate approach than what we saw, which was obviously anything but. But what this does demonstrate is that if there is disagreement, then the militant wing is not afraid to undertake an enormous operation and put Gaza's very existence into significant danger. And so I think we have to kind of reconsider the power of not just the military power of the militant wing, but almost the political influence that that wing is extending and has extended through this conflict.
I'd also add one small point about capability, which is their firepower, I think, is really impressive. They fired more rockets on one day on October 7th, many, many thousands, than they fired in the entirety, or almost as many as they fired in the entirety of their 2014 war with Israel. And, you know, their arsenal has grown. It's grown in sophistication. They showed off pictures of Hamas launching loitering munitions of the kind that Russia's firing against Ukraine in recent days. And they used gliders to also conduct effectively what airborne assaults. They succeeded in launching airborne assaults that Russia could not successfully launch against Ukraine in February 2022. So we really have to get away from the idea this is a purely a terrorist organization that conducts terrorist acts via typical terrorist means. It is also a conventional armed force of some capability.
Right. Well, that raises the obvious questions. If you are fighting a conventional armed force of significant capability and your stated objective, as the Israeli objective is, as I understand, is to destroy it, what alternative is there but to go in and invade Gaza and occupy it, Shashank?
There isn't. There isn't an alternative. You can degrade it, you can weaken it, but every war of the last 10 years, or 15, 16 years, has ended in some kind of ceasefire. It's weakened Hamas. There's been a new return to a new normal, a peace agreement brokered often by Egypt, and then a return to the status quo. Now, you can't do that if you want to destroy them, but you can only destroy them by going in, occupying it for what I think would be many, many months, if not years, and rooting them out. And I'll just point out here very simply, there's 500 kilometers of subterranean tunnels underneath Gaza that Hamas has built, strengthened, relied on, and has now sprinkled hostages throughout. So if Israel wants to durably take Hamas out, and of course that leaves aside the question, what follows, who then governs Gaza, then it is going to have to occupy the strip of 2 million people and administer it under international law of occupation for a long time. And I think I struggle to understand how the Israeli political class and the Israeli military is going to be able to swallow that.
Shashank Joshi there with Jennifer Jeffries. Just before we move on, you're listening to this as a podcast, but you may not be quite aware of just how many other podcasts there are available in this series, like the one about the UK and the European Convention on Human Rights, the one about the coup in Niger, and the one about whether we can meet the net zero challenge. Right, now I want to explore the political and geopolitical implications of these events. Joining me in the briefing room to discuss that is David Makovsky, Ziegler Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute and Director of the Koret Project on Arab-Israel Relations. David, there have been changes in the Israeli cabinet since the events of last weekend. Can you just take us through what they are and what importance they have?
Look, these are big changes. You're taking two people that are widely seen in the public as being a kind of a steady hand, who are each former heads of the military. One is Benny Gantz. He was the Israel Defense Forces chief of staff. He was the top official. And then his successor is a guy by the name of Gadi Eisenkot, same position. As it turns out, the two of them are very close, and they are in a centrist party that many Israelis have looked to as a way to offset some of the hard right elements in his party. Now, Bibi Netanyahu does not want to do subtraction, but he's willing to do addition. I'll add new ones, but I'm not going to kick out the old ones. And Gantz said, I'll join anyway. The country's at war, and we have to come and rally to the flag. And so you've created this war management cabinet, it's called. Officially, it's three people. It's the prime minister, the defense minister, and Benny Gantz, the head of the party. And then you have two observers, but it's clear that the two observers are going to be very active. And those five will be taking the ultimate decisions on military moves. And what it does is sends a signal both within Israel and outside of Israel that the considerations are going to be purely made on a professional basis. Now, doesn't mean that everything's going to go smoothly. If you're going to have a ground operation in Gaza or a second front with Hezbollah in northern Lebanon, this is going to be very difficult. Anything on the ground is going to be bloodier. And Hamas has had time for booby traps. Netanyahu is famously risk averse, even though he's been associated with the hard right. But if you look at the previous rounds in Gaza, what you'll see is that he never goes on the ground. He stays in the air because it minimizes the risks of Israeli casualties. And, you know, house-to-house warfare, it could be a bloody business and civilians could be killed. And I think that's probably still going to happen. But I think it's in Israel's interest that there's a distinction as much as possible between Hamas that perpetrated this unfathomable atrocity and innocent Gazans who can't really vote Hamas out because Hamas has the guns.
Okay, and how does Iran fit into all this?
If there's indications that Iran is trying to push Hezbollah to act and open a second front, and they are a proxy of Iran. And by the way, the Islamic Jihad is an extension of the Iranian government. I wouldn't call Hamas that in either of those categories because I tend to think that Hamas is a little more independent minded. But I thought from the first day that I said, I wonder if Iran is trying to press now because the Biden administration has been working on this White House initiative of a U.S.-Saudi defense treaty and twin it with the Saudi-Israeli peace normalization. And this would be a threat to radical groups in the region like Hamas and like the Iranians and Hezbollah to say, hey, we're being eclipsed by this kind of pragmatic alliance. And if we want to block this and be spoilers, the way to do it is do atrocities in Israel, you know, trigger an Israeli retaliation that is very harsh. And then hopefully those photos in the Arab world will be such that on an Arab satellite television that will constrain the Saudis from going forward. Can I prove it, though? I cannot prove it. But they've been supporting, like I said, Hamas for years. They've been bankrolling the Islamic Jihad. Islamic Jihad, I believe, holds 30 of these hostages in Gaza themselves. I don't have a smoking gun to prove that they orchestrated this very move for this broader purpose of being a regional spoiler. But I think the fact that there's a U.S. Gerald Ford aircraft carrier now coming off the coast of the Eastern Mediterranean, going to the coast of the eastern part of the Mediterranean, is a sign that the U.S. is concerned enough to warn. And now we've seen two warnings from Biden. If you think you can exploit this tragedy, you know, don't do it.
Let's look at the longer term picture for a moment. I mean, for some time now, we've had this pattern of several years of coexistence of Hamas in Gaza, punctuated, you know, with rocket attacks, tunnel attacks, then the Israelis retaliate, usually by air, and then it goes back to the same old, same old. Now, I just want to get it clear for our listeners. Is your sense that this attack, by its scale and what's happened, fundamentally alters Israel's perception of whether that coexistence is still possible?
I do think it does, because there was a hope in certain circles in Israel that said if we only improve things economically for them in certain ways, the burdens of governance, the economic inducements will create a certain accommodationalist approach and tip the internal balances within Hamas in a pragmatic direction. That was kind of the hope of some of the people in the system. And the fact that, you know, Qatar, with Israel's urging, I should add, was giving $30 million a month to Gaza. I think that school of thought is kind of really lost out. I mean, I looked up this global terrorism database of all the terror attacks since 1970 in the world. This is now in third place in terms of fatalities. So it is such a traumatic blow that I think it has led to a reassessment of Hamas. You know, they always saw them as terrorists, but I think they thought there might be some mutual accommodation. And I think that school seems to have vanished right now. And it has led to this belief that you could do an all-out assault. The key is making the distinction between Hamas and innocent Gazans, and that is going to be the test here. And what would come after Hamas if you did end it as a fighting force? What would come in its place? You know, this is going to be asked, which is this retaliatory move, what is it going to lead to? What's the strategy?
Exactly. And the big questions arise out of that. And so what I think I'm trying to get is your best judgment of if Israel is determined to destroy Hamas, what it actually has to do now in order to do that. And then once it has done that, if we think it can achieve it, what it has then to do in order to maintain that situation.
I have to believe the Israeli intelligence system, although it failed, let's say, last Saturday, when it comes to trying to identify Hamas's assets on the ground is something that's what they do every day in terms of keeping track with that. So I think, you know, there's airstrikes now, and I assume they're going to go after what's ever on the ground. Things are complicated underground with all these tunnels, because I assume that there's whatever it is, if the number is 150 or whatever the precise number of hostages are, they're going to try to take them as human shields, believing that it will give them some protection. And this will be a huge change of the Israeli ethos, which is always leave no person behind. I think the Israeli ethos is now going to be tested and is going to say, listen, we can't make that what stops. Israel is going to have to, you know, prosecute this war. But the question is, tell me what happens the day after, as your question is. And I don't know if we have great answers. Like, clearly you want a situation, I think, ideally, that the Palestinian Authority from the West Bank takes over. I don't think they're ready to take over. The question is what it would be in the interim, and how long is that interim, and how do you know for sure? Some say, no, Israel's just going to have to stay and occupy these people. Israel got out of Gaza in 2005, and there are very few Israelis that ever want to go back there. You know, we're not in the realm of like the good and the great ideas. We're in the zone of like the suboptimal, I would say. But could there be some interim, maybe Arab trusteeship? Egyptian would be the best, obviously, for X number of years to help rebuild Gaza so it's not a place of misery. There's some modicum of hope. Could there be a residual force takes over? And is a trustee until the PA in the West Bank is ready. But I just think Israel is saying never again is this going to happen. And they will look for any sort of alternative. But when you ask them, what is that alternative now? They'll just say, first, we have to win. I think you have to think about what happens the day after.
So that's very interesting, because one of the things that you're suggesting is that there will be created a vacuum after a very, very bloody interregnum, and that actually it's the Arab states who might be asked to fill that vacuum.
That's been my view, that you have to see it as a trusteeship. It can't be said that we're taking Gaza away from the Palestinians, because then they'll say, oh, you're selling us out, you're taking our land. And no one wants their land. You know, that's the irony in the whole story. No one wants it. But it would have to be viewed as like a time period arrangement. I mean, because for a lot of the Arabs, Gaza's quicksand. It's like, what do we get out of this? You know, we'll just be the targets. We don't want to be the targets. And Hamas might say, whatever's left of it, oh, you're doing Israel's bidding or whatever. So I think a trusteeship over time that you'll ultimately hand this off to the PA when the PA has capacity. But in the meantime, we're going to just rebuild Gaza economically. I think that's something to think about.
David Makovsky. My thanks to him and to Jennifer Jeffries and Shashank Joshi. And my conclusion really is that what's coming will be grim and complicated, so best make sure you get your information from people who know what they're talking about. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, it's Amol.
And I'm Nick, and we're launching the Today podcast from Radio 4.
Come on then, what is it, Nick?
Well, every week we're going to take a big subject we want to spend more time on, because I don't know about you, when I present the Today programme, I'm always thinking of things I wish I'd asked, I wish I'd heard, and this is going to give us the time to do that, to get more analysis, more insight, sometimes more gossip.
Same goes for me. I'm looking forward to this. Episodes will drop every Thursday. It's called the Today podcast, and you can listen now on BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.